I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Please be seated.
At this point, I want to turn the mic over to my longtime friend and colleague, Justice Douglas.
Good morning, and we'll be very brief. We are approaching campaign season, and I need to make it easier for those who wish to apply for certain jobs or certain positions. I will be retiring at the end of my term, so I'm not leaving today or tomorrow. I will still be around to do whatever you think I do for another year, but I will be retiring at the end of that. I'm thankful to Governor Miller, who appointed me to the District Court, as well as Governor Gwynn, who appointed me to the Supreme Court, and to our citizens and residents of the state of Nevada, who voted for me and kept me in office for some 22 plus years. So with that, that is my announcement.
And not to outdo Justice Douglas, but to join Justice Douglas today, it is with deep heartfelt and mixed emotions that I announce today that I will not seek re-election to seat C of the Nevada Supreme Court. I will complete my current term and retire on the first Monday of January 2019. So you're going to see me for another 13 months, so don't count on me out yet, please. I will serve Chief Justice Douglas as his Associate Chief Justice for the calendar year of 2018. We decided to make this announcement today, both Justice Douglas and I, because filing starts in January for judicial offices, not like the regular filing, which is in March for everybody else, but judges file, you know, whether it be for the District Court or the District Court or the Supreme Court. So I wanted to give everybody a chance, just as Justice Bob Rose gave me the chance in 2006 by announcing his retirement, and that's when I decided to run for the Supreme Court. So that's why we're announcing this today. And I do want to thank the people of the state of Nevada who have been very kind to me. 28 years as a practicing attorney, and now 20 years, 8 years on the District Court bench, and 12, it'll be 12 years on the Supreme Court bench. Luckily, I'm going to retire like Rocky Marciano, undefeated four elections, and had to beat none of the above twice, which is tough. But I do want to thank the people of the state of Nevada for giving me this great opportunity. When I grew up, I never dreamed that I would achieve the goals that I would achieve, but I couldn't have done it without colleagues like this and my two colleagues who are not here today. They're not on these cases this morning, Justice Pickering and Justice Carter. Can tell it's tough for me today. This is very emotional for me, having been here 47 years. I'm the senior on this court as far as dog years, as Mike always says. I've been on this court since 2007, and it's been a real pleasure to be here. I just want to leave everybody with this one thought. I said this during my speech to the state of the judiciary, about the judiciary in the state of Nevada. I'm very proud to have been a member now for these upcoming 20 years. But I want to say about the state of the judiciary, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, from the state of Nevada, for the confidence you put in me for these years to be a member of the District Court and the Supreme Court of Nevada. And with that, I made it through it without any tears. Let me call the first case, which is 74326. Okada versus District Court, Wynn Resorts Limited. Mr. Morris for the petitioners. Mr. Folsenberg's here for the petitioner, and Mr. Bice for the real parties in interest. You ready to go?
Yes, but before I start my time, let me say, and I now speak for Mr. Bice and Mr. Morris and the entire state bar of Nevada, that I commend the two of you on your great careers and the great job that you have both done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so that your time starts running, I'm going to ask you, Mr. Folsenberg, why should this group, this five Supreme Court justices, intervene in this case at this time? Why should we intervene?
Dan Folsenberg for Elaine Wynn. Your Honor, that's a good question, and that's the kind of question you would ask, considering you're opinion on interlocutory petitions. I think it's important for two reasons. It's an issue of statewide importance. The correct interpretation, and I would contend the correct determination on retroactivity of 463.120 subsection 6 is an issue that affects a statewide importance. And it doesn't just affect Okada, although in a footnote, Mr. Bice asks why Elaine Wynn is here. Elaine Wynn also in this case had discovery requests that go to the meaning and application of this statute. But besides having statewide importance, it's also good for the proper administration of justice of this case. This is a big case. This case currently has 7 writ petitions. If you remember in the Beezer case, this court didn't hear an issue of class certification. And then after we tried the case for 3 months, we came up on direct appeal and it was reversed and sent back down to be tried again, as opposed to the endoscopy case, where we came up on a question there having to do with expert evidence. But because the court took that case and decided it before the trials took place, we were able to do proper trials with the correct rule of law and not have to come back again and try them. So if you don't hear it now, and Mr. Bice does make the argument that this, you shouldn't hear writ petitions on orders granting discovery, but this is different. This is an important legal issue, and if you don't hear it now and we come up on direct appeal and you order the discovery to be done, we'll have to try the case over again. Let me also address retroactivity, because I think that's the critical issue in this case. Mr. Morris is going to address the very many other issues that we have here. In the petition, we cite Sandpoint, and Sandpoint several times. And I think Sandpoint is an excellent example of how to do the analysis for retroactivity. First, you look at whether the statute, the amendment to the statute, has any retroactive effect. And then you look at whether that's prohibited. And I think, actually, this is a so much easier case than Sandpoint. And that's another reason why I think the court should hear it, because I don't think it will take very much work for the court to resolve retroactivity. Because both of those questions, whether it's retroactive effect and whether it is prohibited, are answered by Section 2 of Senate Bill 376. Section 2 says that this new subsection 6 of the statute, which seems to create purportedly an absolute privilege, applies to requests made after the effective date. Now, in Sandpoint, the petitioner argued that the change in the deficiency judgment should only apply to judgments that were entered after the effective date of the statute. And this court said no. It should be deficiencies, not judgments. It should be the point of the sale, the foreclosure sale or the judicial sale, because that's when the deficiency is established. Same thing here. The request, it's very unusual to create a privilege and apply it to communications that have already taken place. And this statute purports to do that. Now, there are constitutional issues involved, but you don't even have to address the constitutional issue if you hold that the statute is not applicable, because the requests that were made here, both by Okada and Aruzzi and by Elaine Wynn, all were before the effective date of the statute. And is that prohibited? Yes. This is easy. Unlike Sandpoint, which said that the statute is effective upon passage, here the statute amendment actually goes so far as to say it applies only to requests made afterwards. These requests were before the amendment to the statute should not apply. Let me turn the lectern over to Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. So that means my remarks will be, and perhaps you'll characterize that as merciful.
Sure.
Following on what Mr. Halsenberg argued, I want to say to you that I don't believe we are here to discuss the application of the business judgment rule. We are concerned with a specific statute that is not in Chapter 78. We're concerned with 463.120 sub 6. Sub 6 is the new section. Section 2 of SB 376, which creates this amendment, says unmistakably that it is creating a privilege. It's not providing for a procedural aspect of application of privilege. It is creating a privilege in the amendatory provisions of this act. Now, the district court apparently didn't believe or didn't accept the proposition that the privilege being created cannot be applied retroactively, even though, as Mr. Paulsenberg told you, the statute says it applies only to requests that are made on or after June 12, 2017. And what we are dealing with here are communications that were the subject of a request by way of a request for production of documents and motion and follow-on motion practice for that that started in 2013.
Mr. Morris, should we be concerned at all because of the fact that the original request went on, so we get into after the new statute comes into play for this motion to compel?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that I understand that argument. I don't believe that it's one that should be accepted because the statute doesn't say, doesn't address motion practice after June 12, 2017. It says a request made on or after, I said June 12, 2017, is what this statute applies to. The request, I don't know how to say it any more plainly than we put in writing, we filed and served a request for the production of these communications in 2014, almost 3 years before this statute took effect. Now, the district court didn't honor that and didn't, I don't believe, take the legislature's lead there and say that we're dealing here with a request that was made earlier. What she said was the motion is being heard now, so the statute applies. That just isn't what the statute says either. The legislature did say we don't want this statute to apply to requests that are made prior to June 12, 2017 is when the governor signed this bill.
Mr. Morris, reviewing the transcript of the hearing, it doesn't appear as though the court, district court, devoted much time to assessing the meaning of the word request. Do you consider that to be ambiguous at all, given the parties' conflicting approaches to the word, and does it make a difference?
No, I don't believe request is ambiguous, and I don't believe that you're quite correct. But the judge devoted much in the way of attention to that particular word. And that's one of the reasons why.
So if this court were to interpret the word request as used in the statute as being a request for discovery under the discovery rules,
well, certainly, but that
then, this statute would arguably not apply. It appears critical to the district court's decision that the judge concluded that request in this context was a motion to compel discovery.
That's correct. You are correct.
So is the interpretation of the word request or its definition as used in the statute important to the outcome of this case?
Well, the answer to your question is yes. And it is important. We contend, the district court disagreed, that this statute does not apply to a request that was made before the statute was created.
What is your view of the ordinary usage or meaning of the word request, because the term is not defined in the statute?
Well, that may be true, Your Honor. The term is not defined in the statute, nor is the phrase in connection with, defined in the statute. These statutes, or this statute, was written for in the service of the legal profession. And the legal profession understands, and I don't believe the legislature indicated in its amendment to this statute, anything different than what we would consider a request. Lawyers in litigation make requests all the time. We request the production of documents. We request admissions of fact. We request information by filing interrogatories. And all of those things we did. And we did those prior to the creation of this statute. So, Your Honor,
your point is that we should equate the use of the word request in this newly created privilege with rules 37A, 37A2B, or 63,
341 even. Sure. I don't see any problem with that.
You have about 3 minutes.
Well, I'm under the 5 minutes I wanted to reserve, and although I'd like to continue talking to you, remember I said merciful. I'll conclude my remarks and save what little time is left for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Weiss. If you could answer the question that I asked Mr. Holzenberg, should we intervene today?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. The answer to your question is no. And the reason is this is not in order that is compelling discovery, which is where this court has indicated that it would entertain interlocutory writ review, because in those limited circumstances when the court has compelled discovery, there is no effective opportunity for appellate review after the fact, because once the order is complied with, the discovery has been satisfied. In this case, the order is an order denying a request for discovery, denying a motion to compel. That is an order that can be reviewed if the complaining party remains aggrieved at the end of the case, which we do not believe that they will, but if they were somehow aggrieved at the end of the case, then they would could have that matter reviewed by way of ordinary appeal. And that's
besides my concern with that is what Mr. Goldenberg said, and he used that class action case.
Absolutely.
That wasted months of juror time when we said the class wasn't properly certified later. Why shouldn't we just tackle it now, whichever way we go with it, and you move on from there?
Just to give us a fair question, but those circumstances are instances where the court is entertaining an issue that's going to impact the substance of the case. This is a question about privilege over a discrete set of communications between the chairman of our compliance committee, Governor Miller, at the time, and the Nevada Gaming Control Board.
I'm not so sure that the privilege is that discrete. This privilege, at least the way it was discussed and argued in the district court, is pretty broad. So had this thing floated up in 2011, it raises an interesting question. Would one be able to assert the position that the Wynn parties or Wynn resorts have taken with regard to the Okada redemption, and then say, but we don't have to give you anything. We're relying on this statute because we gave everything to the Gaming Commission and Gaming Control Board. What is this thing?
Well, Justice Hardesty, I understand the question about how broad it is. I actually think that it is fairly broad. Which, again, though, I would also submit counsels for why the matter should not be resolved by way of an interlocutory order. Because if the court is going to have to address the breadth of it, it's going to have to understand exactly the context in which the communications were involved and how they relate to the underlying merits of the case. And that's why I disagree with Mr. Morris when he says that the business judgment rule aspect of the case, which the district court has now ruled in favor of the majority of the board, is somehow not implicated here. I think it is absolutely implicated here relative to the types of discovery that should be sought and that should be allowed.
In reading your opposition to the writ petition, you offer a number of other reasons why the court's ruling should be recognized by us and not entertain the writ, but the sole basis on which the district court acted in this instance was this statute. So
that's absolutely
I'm
true.
Not sure that we're really in a position to vet all of the various arguments that you raised, all of which might be meritorious, but the district court didn't even discuss those.
Justice Hennessey, I agree with that. Our point being, I would submit, is another reason why interlocutory review of an order denying a right or denying a motion to compel discovery is all the more appropriate. There are a host of alternate grounds that we advanced below to the district court. You're right, the district court did not address them because the district court views the statute as being clear on its face, which I'll address in a moment because I actually think that the district court is right on that. But look at the consequences. If the court were to intervene now, it would have to remand the matter back to the district court to consider the other alternatives that have been raised. And that sort of back and forth, to get to Justice Gibbons' point, could go on quite extensively. This isn't a case like Beezer, or where the decision is going to somehow impact the scope of trial and thus somehow has some significant, significant consequences for the scope of trial. This ruling is very discreet on certain, as it currently stands, on certain communications that were between Governor Miller and the Gaming Control Board. So that's why, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, we do not believe that this merits this court's extraordinary review at this point in time. And even if it did, and the court somehow disagreed with the district court, it would have to remand it back down for the consideration of the other points. So let me turn...
Were those other points asserted in the motion practice on this issue in the district court?
Yes, they were, Justice Hennessey. Your record here is a little bit incomplete on the following point because Ms. Wynn has joined in this petition, but Ms. Wynn had her own separate motion to compel, and that was opposed by Mr. Wynn, and that is also extensively briefed, these additional points that are not part of your record just due to the speed in which this matter is currently in front of the court. So let me turn then, if I might, to just this point about what the statute actually says. But the statute, SB 376, members of the court, is on its face, is designed to clarify the law. Because I would submit that gaming companies have long maintained, and we maintained at the time of discovery, that existing Nevada law made those communications, particularly a licensee going to the Gaming Control Board and reporting what it believed was impropriety, in this case by Mr. Alcala, to be protected and privileged. Well, the company had always maintained that. That's why when the discovery requests were served, they were objected to. And there was no motion to compel filed on that until multiple years later.
Mr. Hennessey, you talked about the statute, and one of the things that's very clear in reading this new statute is there's a certain tension. And there's a tension with the state and the gaming control wanting to make them the overall authority on everything gaming,
mm-hmm.
and the courts in terms of resolution of civil disputes between parties. And we are looking at what normally is a, and I'll use the term, fist fight between two parties. And with this statute, one party is now unarmed. Previously, the statute allowed for certain discovery if the court thought it was appropriate. Now, the court's been completely taken out in the resolution of civil disputes, which is a side venture, but coming full play back, as you said, and despite part of what you said, we have been killing trees on this case by the forest lately. So we have a fairly good idea of what's involved in the many aspects. But for this motion before the court, as Justice Hardesty has said, all we have is a district court making this singular ruling, not ruling as it was because the court seemed so sure that this was the proper way to go. We're here as that surety put forth. And a law that says prospective only, and then looking at when this process started to see whether which window it fits into.
All right, Justice, let me address with go about it this way. I actually do not think that the law, and this is where I think that Mr. Morris and I part company significantly, the law does not say prospective only, I would submit. But the law, what the legislature was clarifying there is in Section 2, what it's actually saying, in my view, is that this statute applies to any communications. The question in Section 2 is whether or not, when is the triggering date of the effective date of the statute. This statute applies whether a communication that occurs after the effective date of the statute is just as privileged as a communication that occurred before the effective date of the statute 10 years ago. If that request, if the information is only being sought now, the statute still applies to it. The legislature didn't say that there are certain categories of communications that are privileged that relate to the Gaming Control Board's enforcement matters or rights and not. I would submit what the legislature is saying in Section 2 is they're all covered. The question is what is the effective date of the statute? And that's why the word, I would submit, Justice Hardesty, you made the statement of, is this trigger in the statute, the significant word, is it the word request? And I would submit, no, that's not the most significant. The word immediately preceding it is the most significant, any request. A request covers a broad spectrum of things. Just, by the way, contrary to what the other side is arguing, this is not part of the rules of civil procedure. This is a statute that governs requests made to licensees by a whole host of people outside of litigation. That could be a oral request, it could be a written request, it could be correspondence. What this statute says is that any request made after the effective date of the statute is covered. Their motion to compel, which is the only jurisdiction that which prompts the district court's order, which is the trigger for this court's jurisdiction, is a request that was made after the effective date of the statute. That's why the word, I would submit, the most critical word, if we want to focus on a particular word, is the word any. Because any means all in this context. All requests that are made after the effective date of the statute are covered. And it has to be that way, I would submit, because otherwise the court's going to be involved in the vagaries of, well, when was this particular request made? Were there earlier requests? Were there later requests? Was there a oral request? Was there a red letter written? I would submit that the statute is plain on its face. Any request made after the effective date of the statute is barred by the statute. Their motion to compel is such a request. They did not file a motion to compel before the adoption of the statute. And they know that. And that's why we're here. And that's another reason why I would submit. Writ review of this particular order is very problematic in advance, because the court is now, the unique circumstances of what they're arguing because their discovery requests in the rules of civil procedure predated the effective date of the amendment. That somehow gives them the ability to go around the statute and say that the court should order production of the communications, even if those exact same requests for the exact same information had been made after the effective date of the statute, they would be protected from disclosure. So I don't think that's what the legislature would do.
In substance, you would agree then if they had made their motion to compel prior to the statute, they'd be fine. But your position is that statute, their motion to compel, which is made after, but requested before, and somehow invalid.
Justice Douglas, I don't agree that it would be fine, because I believe that we will always maintain that actually this is a clarifying statute. We have always maintained and long maintained that these communications were protected under Nevada law to begin with.
That's a whole different issue.
That is a different issue. I agree with you. But is there some significance, Justice Douglas, to the timing of their request? No. Any request, whether it's a motion, whether it's a written letter, whether it's an oral request for the information, any request after the effective date of the statute is covered by the statute. That's what the that's what the legislature said in Section 2. The word any in this context, I would submit, is not ambiguous. Because if the court goes down that path, then we're going to get into Justice Hardesty's question of, well, what is a request? Is a phone call a request? Is a letter a request? Is an email a request? That you could end up in an endless debate of what, quote, a request, end quote, means. But in this context, I submit the court doesn't have to do that, because any request made after the effective date of the statute applies to. It doesn't matter whether that communication occurred 25 years ago to the Gaming Control Board, or whether it occurs 6 months from today. It doesn't matter. Any request is covered by it, and that's why we submit.
Mr. Bice.
Yes, Justice Hardesty.
A question. clarification argument, what subsection of NRS 463.120 do you think subsection is clarifying?
Subsection.
In what way does it clarify?
We believe, Your Honor, if you look at the bill itself, AB 376, it specifically is talking about the Legislative Council's digest. Right at the beginning of the bill specifically talks about the fact that existing law provides privilege. What we had also argued to the district court, and in particular was argued on Ms. Wynn's motion, but isn't part of the record in this case, was that NRS 49.025 in conjunction with 164.120 sub 4 had provided protection for communications. So let me give you an example. I don't recall exactly where it's at in the statute, but the statute had provided protection for informants. Someone informing on someone to the Gaming Control Board, like Governor Miller did. He informed on the Okada parties to the Gaming Control Board about what was going on and the investigation that was ensuing. We have always maintained at the time that the statute, sub 4 of the same statute, protected that information from discovery and provided protection. And I would submit that's what the Legislative Council Bureau is talking about when they say existing law provides a certain information and data provided to gaming applicants and licensees are confidential and privileged. It was already provided for in the statute. What it goes on to state is that sections 1.4 of this bill clarify the privilege. That's the point we would submit. And I see I'm out of time, and I thank the court for its time, and Mr. Chief Justice and Justice Douglas, thank you very much for your service.
Thank you. Mr. Morris, your rebuttal?
3 minutes, 3.5 minutes.
Paul, we're going to 30 seconds, you said?
This will be a miracle.
Now it's public. Justice Hardesty, I think Mr. Bice took a lot of my thunder. I think request means any request. It doesn't just mean discovery requests. If Mr. Sebelius were still here and had made a request, if a member of the public had made a request, I think it covers any request. So I don't think it can be, even then with that broad meaning, it can't be limited to motions to compel. What does the statute actually mean? You know, in Sandpoint, I argued what I thought 40.459 actually meant. And this court said we don't need to get to what it actually means because it's not applied retroactively.
Thank you. Ms. Morris.
Briefly, I'd like to turn to the question, well, more than one of you has addressed this subject, and that is clarification. What is this statute clarifying? The argument that the Wynn parties make to you, or Wynn resorts make to you, has to do with the legislative digest. That's where the word clarify appears. That isn't a legislative word. It isn't something the legislature said. It's something that an employee of the Legislative Reference Bureau wrote an explanation of his view of what this statute did. You had, this is the enrolled bill, SB 376, you had that issue before you in Sandpoint. And what you said in Sandpoint just a few years ago through Justice Sata was this: when the statute is clear, when the words are not ambiguous, we don't need to and we will not, because we are not governed by what the legislative digest says. So in interpreting this statute, we disregard the legislative digest. Look at the statute the way it's written. The way it's written, Mr. Bice has gone over this with you, but I would like to go over the same subject with you and point out this is what the legislature actually said in Section 2 of SB 376. These are the legislature's words. They're not mine.
They are not the Legislative Digest author's words. It said, the confidentiality and privilege set forth in the amendatory provisions of this act apply to any request made on or after the effective date of this act. It didn't say, and the legislature did not, I submit to you, intend that it meant to address a request that had been made but dishonored more than 2 years prior to the act being passed. With that, Your Honors, and joining Mr. Paulsenberg and Mr. Bice and thanking you, Justice Douglas and Justice Cherry, for your service, I conclude my remarks and look forward to your positive order.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Thank you, Mr. Paulsenberg. Thank you, Mr. Bice. This matter